Amen. Well, I heard of this fellow named Jimmy. He got this letter, and in it said, "Dearest Jimmy, no words could ever express the great unhappiness I've felt since breaking our engagement. Please say you'll take me back. No one could ever take your place in my heart, so please forgive me. I love you, I love you, I love you. Yours forever, Marie. P.S. Congratulations on winning Lotto 649. I'm glad some people got it. There's only a few people in the room, but they did laugh. Love. Love, love, love. All you need is love. Love is all you need. Seems like a certain famous group sang a song about that. What is love, anyways? Well, I hope that we can shed a little bit of light on that age-old question. What is love? Now we've been looking at 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3 to 8 in quite some detail over the last number of months. And today we've come to the last couple of steps in this sort of divine human cooperation, collaborative thing where we work with God to become effective and productive as believers. And so we've had these steps of faith, goodness, knowledge, adding self-control, adding perseverance, adding godliness. And now we've come to the last two, brotherly kindness and love. So we're told in verse 5, make every effort to add to your faith. And then there's a bunch of things that are to be added. And then in verse 7, and add to godliness, brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness, love. These are steps 6 and 7. Now I've lumped the last two steps together because they're kind of related. And in fact, they're so closely related that sometimes they're used into Greek words for brotherly kindness and love. And in fact, a lot of times in the New Testament, they're actually, those two words are translated exactly the same way into English. You probably know a little more Greek than you think you do. In fact, I'm pretty sure you know the Greek words, brotherly kindness and love. You see, the Greek word translated brotherly kindness is Philadelphia. See? You're a Greek scholar. You didn't know it, did you? And the word translated love is agape. Again, you probably knew that. Philadelphia and love. These are two words that often are translated as love in the Bible. So it says, if we put this a little bit of Greek and English together, the verse says, make every effort to add to your faith godliness, and to godliness Philadelphia, and to Philadelphia agape. Now, obviously, we're not talking about the city of Philadelphia. I know it's the city of brotherly love. That's what it means. But the word Philadelphia, which means that, basically has this high idea of friendship, fun, a relational love, a reciprocated affection, of really dear, close friends. That's what Philadelphia means. Now, agape is very similar in its meaning, but it includes this idea of the love being unconditional. It's like no matter what, you're going to love. There's this mutuality. It's not necessarily a mutual love. It can be a one-way love. It's just a higher plane of love than Philadelphia. So when my kids were born, I experienced this whole new appreciation for this term agape. Because when my kids were born, they were just a little bundle of, you know, joy, they say, but actually screams a lot and everything and cute and everything. But they didn't do anything for me, really, right? All they're going to do is cost me a whole tens of thousands of dollars over the next couple of decades. And they were going to cost me a lot of grief and a lot of frustration and all that kind of stuff. And yet, I just absolutely loved them for who they were without them doing anything for me. I totally love them. But they couldn't reciprocate that love. Not when they were born. They do now. But back then, no. But I'm telling you, the moment I saw them, I was in total love. And it's weird. You know, Aaron and Jason, they both got engaged recently. And all of a sudden, I started feeling the same kind of familiar love to their girlfriends as I have for them. It's like weird. They haven't done anything to earn my love, but I love them deeply, deeper than I ever imagined I would. And it's quite a weird sense. Like all of a sudden, oh, I love these ladies. And that's agape love. It doesn't need to be reciprocated. It's just there. It exists. Now, as I mentioned, agape and Philadelphia are two words that are often interchanged in the New Testament. There's one example in the New Testament in John chapter 21, verse 15 and 17. The English has the word love seven times in those three verses. But the Greek uses agape and phileo. That's the short version of Philadelphia. In that same passage. It's sort of interchangeably. You might remember the story. It's a story of, it's after the resurrection. Peter's probably still feeling a little discouraged because he denied Christ three times. And so he says to six other disciples, hey, I'm going to go fishing. And the six disciples say, hey, we'll go with you. And so they go off fishing. And you know, you have to remember that they're out there fishing. This was their occupation before Christ called them to be fishers of men. Right? And so, wouldn't you know it, they fish all night for fish, not people, and they catch nothing. And wouldn't you know it, in the morning, Jesus shows up. I just love this, you know, like, he shows up, kind of catches them red-handed, doing what they used to be doing and not doing the job he told them to do. And he says, hey kids, you catch any fish? No, we fished all night, haven't caught a thing. Throw your nets on the other side of the boat. I'm sure you'll catch something. And they do. They throw their nets on the other side of the boat. And they have this huge haul of big fish. 153 to be exact, actually. And John says, it's the Lord. And Peter goes, no way. And he dives off the boat and he swims to shore. and then they have this beautiful breakfast feast. And then after breakfast, Jesus takes Peter aside and says to him, Peter, do you love me more than these? But he's using the word agape. Do you agape me more than these? And Peter replies, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. He doesn't use the same word. They're both translated as love in English. But in Greek, there's a subtle difference going on. And probably Peter doesn't really even notice that he's doing that. It's a word that's used interchangeably with one another. But it's almost like Peter can't quite bring himself to say, Lord, I love you unconditionally, because he knows that Jesus knows that he betrayed or disowned him three times just a few nights before Jesus was crucified. And so when Jesus asked him again, Peter, son of John, do you agape me? And Peter responds, yes, Lord, you know all things. You know that I phileo you. He says it again. And finally, the third time, Jesus says to him, Peter, Simon, son of John, do you phileo me? Now Jesus is changing the word to phileo. And Peter is grieved because it says that he asked him three times, do you phileo me? Now, actually, he didn't ask him three times. You see what's going on here? The words are used interchangeably. But there's a subtle difference that the one has an unconditional meaning. And it seems like Peter comes up a bit short and he feels badly about it. And each time, Jesus responds, feed my sheep. I love that. If you really love Jesus, our responsibility is to feed his sheep. Our responsibility is to be involved in ministry and to be involved in that thing called fishing for men. That's the responsibility. So Jesus is subtly saying, stop this fishing business, get on with the fishing for men and feeding my sheep business. That's what I've called you to do. So there's a ton of passages in the Bible that talk about love. And as I was you know, I started compiling and I realized, oh, I can't give all these verses. It's just way too much in the New Testament. So I thought we'd just focus on one passage in the Bible, and it's kind of like an iconic passage. It's John, 1 John chapter 4. 1 John is all about love. I mean, the whole book is about love, really. And so in chapter 4, verse 7 through 11, it's kind of this focus on love. And so we're going to have a look at that. John says, "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God." And of course, he's using the word agape in this passage. Before the New Testament, actually, the word agape was not very common in classical Greek. It just, and in ancient Greek, it's just not a common word. But once you get to the New Testament, the New Testament's filled with this word. It's repeated over and over again. And from then on, it enters into the classical Greek, and it becomes a very common word, actually. And it's the New Testament that we have, give thanks to that. It really makes the word. And so you notice that this verse, "Dear friends, let us love one another," is kind of a command. And I think it's harking back to the command that John writes about in his gospel in chapter 13, where Jesus says to the disciples, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." And so you got to ask yourself, do people know that you're a disciple of Jesus Christ because of the love you're expressing? You know, yesterday my neighbor came and used his snowblower to clean my driveway. And I was like, dude, you know, I'm strong. I can do this. But no, he was doing it. Is that the love of Christ? I don't know. But I think that we need to have an expression of love for people that even goes beyond that kind of thing. Is self-sacrificing. That's the kind of love that Christ had. And that's the kind of love that people will take note of. And by this, people will know that you're a disciple of Christ. So it's kind of a challenging question to ask ourselves. Do people recognize Jesus in me because of the love I have for other people? Do they go like, oh, clearly he's a follower of Christ. I mean, look at the way he loves people. That's a challenging question. Notice, too, that it's a command, love one another. And it almost sounds harsh. You know, you can't really command people to love. It kind of like, what are you talking about? In fact, whenever we are coerced to do something, we kind of get this negative feedback. You ever try to tell your kids to do something because I told you so? It doesn't really work. They rebel against that. But Jesus doesn't say, because I told you so. He says, love one another as I have loved you. You see, Jesus gives the ultimate example of love. When Benjamin Franklin wanted to get people interested in the city of Philadelphia, there's that, you have to use the city somewhere. But he wanted to get the people of Philadelphia interested in street lighting. But instead of starting a big campaign to say, hey, you should get street lighting, what he did was he took a lantern and hung it on a branch outside his house. And the light seemed to say, come, check it out. You don't have to stumble on the cobblestones if you walk here because you can see them. And it seemed to be inviting everyone. And soon some of his neighbors hung lanterns out in front of their houses. And before long, there was a whole strip down his street. And people would come from all over the place to walk down his street at night. And went, wow, this is really great. And it wasn't long before the city of Philadelphia was looking for some streetlights. And so it's the same way with the Christian faith. We follow examples, and Christ was the ultimate example of love. It's the same way in Christian families. When they say that if parents attend church faithfully, that 72% of their children will attend church faithfully. If only dad attends the church faithfully, then only 55% of their children will attend church faithfully. Unfortunately, for mothers, it drops down to 15%. If mom attends church, 15% of her offspring will attend church, statistically. And if neither parent attends church, then there's a 6% chance. So the statistics kind of speak for themselves. It's not being told, oh, you should go to church, that sends people to church. It's the example of those we trust and honor. That's what is powerful. And so it is with Jesus. Jesus knows that example is the way to lead. I'm pretty convinced that it's the main reason that Jesus got baptized. I mean, he didn't have any sins, so, and he wasn't confessing belief in Jesus. So why did Jesus get baptized? I'm pretty convinced that it was to set an example for us to get baptized. And so it is with love. He showed the way to love people. I mean, if you look through the Gospels, he's constantly loving people. He's healing people who are sick. He's teaching the truth. He's ministering to the poor. He's fellowshipping with the outcasts, particularly. Jesus lived love. And so Jesus says, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. I seriously doubt that we're ever going to live up to loving like Jesus loved, but we are encouraged to walk in his footsteps. And so the second thing I want to point out from John chapter 4, 1 John 4 is the character of love. So firstly, we saw the command to love. Now I want to look at the character of love. Verse 8 says, whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. You want to know the character of love? Look to God, because God is love. It's his whole being, really. That's quite a passage. You can't claim to be a Christian and not love. If you know God personally, you will also act like he does. You will love. Now, the Bible talks about our understanding of love like seeing it through a glass darkly and only knowing it in part. And then we can only know God partially. We can't know him completely because, well, he's so much different than us. He's so transcendent. But if God is love, then we can't really know love completely either. Because we're mortals, we can't fully comprehend God, and therefore can't fully comprehend love. Just ask someone to explain love. Try it sometime. Just say, how do you know you love someone? And I will guarantee you, in their answer, somewhere along the line, they will say, it's hard to explain. It's always in there. You know, they start explaining it, and then, well, it's kind of hard to explain. It's always there. Why? Because love is so beyond us. It's the character of God, actually. I love the way Paul prays for the Ephesians to experience God's love. He says, and I pray for you that you might be rooted and established in love, and may have power, together with all God's holy people, to grasp how wide and deep, I'm sorry, how wide and long and high. Now, when you use those things, I'm a builder, so, you know, that's a three-dimensional space. How wide, how long, how high. And then he adds a fourth dimension, and how deep, what? That's not three-dimensional anymore. All of a sudden, there's a fourth dimension. And Paul, what are you talking about? Can't have four dimensions. Well, apparently you can. Because he's trying to describe something that can't be described. And then he says, to know this love that surpasses knowledge. Now, I don't know if you catch the oxymoron there, but how do you know something that's beyond knowledge? You know, it's like, what are you talking about? This is a really unique thing that Paul is describing here. He's saying that we can't possibly comprehend it, but I want you to at least try, at least move along in that direction. We're kind of like a child really trying to understand God's love. It's so beyond us. I love what this kid said. He was praying to God, and he says, dear God, I bet it's very hard for you to love everybody in the world. There are only four people in our family, and I can never do it. I love that. Kids' view of God may not be exactly right. But is your view of God exactly right? How do you view, how do you picture God? What is he like? Is he in your heart? Is when he's on your mind, is he like the judge? Is he a kind of a weak old man that's far away? Is he a compromising people person that, you know, allows you to fail? Is he a loving father? Is he a just judge? Is he a harsh, exacting master? What is he to you? Well, probably he's a little bit of all those things according to the Bible. It's interesting, though, to note some of the first glimpses we get of God. We first see God right in the Bible, chapter 1. He's the creator. So, whoa, glorious and great. And then in chapter 2, he's the lawgiver, you know, like don't eat from this tree of knowledge of good and evil. But chapter 3 comes along, and we get this other glimpse of God. And God says, Adam, where are you? God is a seeking God. He's looking for the lost sheep. He's out there moving the bushes around. Where are you, Adam? Now, if you see this as, where are you, Adam? You know, like a policeman, you got the wrong idea. This is like a broken-hearted father. Adam, where are you? Come on. We meet together. We walk in the cool of the evening together. Where are you? That's a broken-hearted father looking for the son he loves. Remember the prodigal son? The story of the two brothers, and the one brother asks for half the inheritance, and then he goes off and squanders it all and spends it all on prostitutes and wild living. And then he comes to the end of himself, and there's a famine in the land, and he ends up feeding pigs, and he's longing to eat the pig food. And finally he thinks to himself, oh man, my servants have it way better. My father's servants have it way better than I have it here in this pig pen. I'm going to go back home. And he goes back home. And the father sees him a long ways off. And instead of being that policeman, here's that wayward son. Looks like he's coming home to beg. No. The father drops everything and runs to meet the son, wraps his arms around him and says, welcome home, son. And the son says, oh, father, I'm not worthy to be called your son. Please call me your servant. And the father says, no. And he welcomes him home and throws a big party. I love this fact that the Reckless Love of God song has become the number one song on the Christian music charts. Because it talks about this idea of God just loving unconditionally. Mark Guy Pearce used to tell the time when he overheard one of his sons saying, you must be good or father won't love you, to the other son. And he called the boys over to him, son, that's not really true. You won't love us if we're bad, will you? The boy asked. Yes, I will love you whether you're good or bad, Pearce explained. But there will be a difference in my love. When you're good, I will love you with the love that makes me glad. And when you're not good, I will love you with a love that makes me sad. And isn't that the truth? That's how God loves us. He loves us all the time, no matter what. But we can make glad the heart of God, or we can make sad the heart of God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. You know, I'm not sure that you can really describe love. God is not the essence of love. He's not the spirit of love. He's not the extreme example of love. He is not the personification of love. He's not the epitome of love. He is love. It's a whole different idea. And we cannot possibly know that until we come into his presence and see him face to face. The last thing I'd like to point out that John talks about here is the crown of love, the absolute epitome of love, the greatest example, the highest, the supreme love.